you need to make things almost effortless for people to actually make an immediate impact. They're holding people to a higher standard. Like, you can't mess with my time. If I'm going to give you my time, if I'm going to give you an hour, it's not going to be wasted. And so you better be able to do something good with it.
I'm Johnny Page.
I'm Matt Verle.
And this is the South County Podcast.
We're here. We're live. Ooh. We're in Austin, Texas.
Woohoo.
Hanging out. Of all the versions of podcasts that we do, many of them were in the Zoom universe, but some of them were fortunate enough to get to hang out in person. And today marks a first. We've got our first ever guest on the podcast. We get a chance to jam with one of our clients who has had a huge role in the vision that we cast for our clients or for our team members. And I'm excited to share some of that today. We've got Mark from Volunteer Matters on. And Mark, I feel like in SaaS Academy, it's common that we share the perfect intro. Why don't you share what's a perfect intro for Volunteer Matters and give us a lowdown on what you wake up every day and do.
Yeah. So we help any organization that has a volunteer workforce with recruiting, onboarding, scheduling, time tracking, reporting for their volunteer workforce.
Mark, I want to give a little bit of context. We just came off of a two-day intensive, and I want to unpack a little bit about where the business is at today, where it's going in the future. And why don't we start off with what is the thing that you found in a room full of 200 and some founders? What's the thing you found people coming to you for? Are you saying, hey, I can help with this, et cetera? Like, what's the thing that people come to you for?
It all boils down to, I think, is mindset. And I think that when you get around a lot of people that have been sort of through it, they can help like strip away some of the blind spots that you have. So I feel like whenever I come to these intensives, it's like eliminating some blind spots. And most of the moments that you have here are like, ah, of course. Like, it was right there in front of me. But sometimes you just get so hyper-focused on something that you don't see something that you would see in someone else's business. So I think clarity is like the most important thing that comes out of these events.
Totally. Yeah. So it's fun getting into a room where everyone is on, it's almost like the same frequency. Hey, we're all looking for what's the thing that we can contribute and what's the thing that we're doing really well. Let's give the audience a sense of Volunteer Matters, kind of where you're at today. Like, describe the business today. What's it look like in terms of team size? How long you've been doing it? What's the revenue look like? What's the average contract value look like? How, you know, give us a sense for what the business looks like today.
Yeah. So we've got five core people and we have some offshore people that do work for us. And we're in the best position we've ever been in business-wise. I feel the most optimistic, I would say, than I ever have. Since we started with SaaS Academy 3 years ago, we went from 30 to 40 to 60 to 105K MRR. And I see it accelerating. And it's just been a lot of little things that we've been sort of enacting over that time. Our churn is fantastic. Some of the people yesterday were, we were talking about churn and they were like, how do you get your churn so low? Like, I think that was one of the things we focused on early on and got that pay dividends. So like, we see nothing but bright things for the future. We just keep, now we're investing a lot in how do we get more eyeballs on us, because we already came in, like, we were very product focused people. Like, when we started eons ago, we built products for other people. So we're really, really good at the product side of things. But as is most cases with really good product people, not so good on the marketing space. So we had this like amazing product that nobody knew about. So that's been a lot of our focus over the last couple of years. And now we have sort of like one, like I always say, you build one sales funnel really, really well. And so that's been really converting. We know what our numbers are. We can just dump some more ingredients at the top of that funnel, have a nice, you know, sausage pie at the end.
Yeah.
You sell entirely to nonprofits, right?
Mostly. We have some municipalities and some for-profit, but it's mostly nonprofits.
I'm hearing is you're doing business on hard mode when it comes to making sales. How do you find that? Like, sales cycle, is it prospecting? Like, those are nonprofits and municipalities. I feel like they're tough nuts to crack,
man. Yeah. You know, it's interesting in the nonprofit space because every nonprofit feels as though they're an enterprise customer. And the sales process is like an enterprise sales process. Because to somebody whose budget is $500,000 a year, spending $3,000 is a lot of money. And then you have somebody who's even a $500 million nonprofit organization, they still have very much have this mindset like every single dime counts. So one of the key things that we've done over the last year or two in particular is moving up market in the nonprofit space because of that, because the sales, number one, because our product actually leans more in that direction, but also just because the sales motion is almost, it's not that much different. It's like we've had some nonprofits that ended up subscribing for $2,000 a year and it took us a year to sell them. So if it's going to take us a year, might as well get one that's going to spend $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It literally is like similar timelines. I mean, we do get people, our average time to close is 90 days.
That's honestly really good for nonprofits and municipalities too.
Kudos, it is.
Man, that's good.
But, and even with that, the beautiful thing is that some of these larger ones that we're seeing some 30K people signing up inside of 90 days. And at the last intensive, one of the things that I like sort of completely ripped off was sole source bidding. And so we were hacking that a little bit around this year. And we got a couple of very large customers who were set to go out to put out an RFP process. And instead we got sole source contracts. So
describe what the difference, what were you doing before? What's a sole source contract?
So whenever there's going to be a big purchase by a major university, a municipality, a large nonprofit, they'll put out a request for information and you fill out a survey about your product. And then they decide whether or not you'll make it to the next round to do a demo. And then you do the demo and they decide whether or not they want to invite you to do a request for proposal. And then you fill out the proposal and they decide who's going to be awarded the contract. And in the past, my thought always was they already knew who they wanted long before this whole process started.
It's like a charade.
But it is. And it's like, because it's required from a compliance standpoint, they're like, well, let's invite five other people in and then eventually select the one that we really wanted in the first place. However, I don't think I'm biased in saying this, but of course it's going to sound like it. We have a better product. And so this last year I said, you know what, I'm going to, because I never responded to these RFP processes before. And I was like, I'm going to just try it this year and see what's up. And we did four of them and we won three of them. So those three contracts were 160K in annually recurring revenue. So I was like, okay, maybe we should be doing more of these. and then the last intensive, what they were talking about is that most of these organizations, they have a process for, well, what happens if there's really only one provider out there that does what we need something to do? You're not going to make us go through this 9-month long process when we know that there are no other products that do this. So that's what a sole source procurement is, or a single source bid, or there's a couple of names for it. So I started asking questions to find out, like, well, what's the maximum dollar amount before you are forced to go to bid by rules and regulations? And if we're above that amount, is there anything in our product that you see that you haven't seen anyplace else in the market? And then they'll say, well, yeah, you guys do this, this, and this like nobody else. And so then I actually developed a packet that I could give to them. I just went and did a Google search and found out, like, when you're making the case internally for the state of California to do a sole source procurement, what questions do they require you to submit? And so I sort of reverse engineered that and provided a document that I just proactively give out to people if there's any chance that there's going to be an RFP.
I'm curious, do you participate in RFPs frequently or no?
This is the first year really where I did them back in the day when we were just doing contract development work. We had a person that just responded to RFPs like full time.
Yeah.
We never won one of them. And that's why I that person I hired for like 6 months, they just responded to RFP after RFP after RFP, and we wouldn't
for it,
nothing. And so that's why I had this thing against them. And then finally I got this one RFP and it's when I read through it, I was like, Jesus, it's like they already selected us the way that they were asking the questions. Cause there are things that we do in the space that nobody else does. And I'm like, well, they want everything that we do. I'll give it a shot.
Man, you're bringing me back to like a previous life. I only have a little experience with this, but we did an RFP when I was doing paramedic training. I had like a private paramedic training company and we did it for the Department of the Navy for this Marine Corps unit that was out of DC. And they sourced it privately. I mean, like, I knew nothing about this and went through the RFP process and wrote the whole thing. And we won it, but my biggest takeaway is it's a massive amount of work for statistically what might be a little payoff if, you know, you're like your previous experience, you don't get them. It's just like the time investment and resource investment and like the depth of some of these RFPs it's crazy.
I spent on the most recent one, I spent 25 hours responding to an RFI.
The precursor, not even the thing.
However, I will say this. So the reason why it took me 25 hours is because I created a ChatGPT persona and I started telling it everything about our product, every RFP we responded to in the past. And then for this one, I was going through and asking it, I call him Ralph, the RFP expert. So I asked Ralph, how would you answer this question? And then he would sometimes give me fantastic answers. And then when he didn't, I would program him with the new information. And so my hope is that the next one that goes around, it'll take at the very least me half the work. And then the ultimate goal is that I could even have my EA go and respond to RFPs if I wanted to, just answer these questions.
A true product guy through and through.
Yeah. How can I do this once?
Right.
You run the business with your brother, right?
I do. So yeah, my brother and I, this goes way back. So I had my very first business was back in the day when you actually had to hardwire computers together with Ethernet in order to have networking. So I did small and medium-sized business networks, exchange servers, and you know, all of that. And my brother did all software development. He's a, you know, computer software engineer, and he had his own software development company. And then we decided to merge the two businesses together during the dot-com boom and made a ton of money in a relatively short amount of time. Thought that that's the way that life was going to be forever, that you just had to open a window and money flew in. And then September 11th happened, and like four of our largest customers, like we were doing minimum like $500,000 development projects. And we had 35 people working for us, an office in Connecticut, one in Manhattan. And our four largest customers after September 11th all go, we're going to put things on hold for a quarter. And being inexperienced as we were, and we were like, okay. And so we had a $200,000 a month nut. So we spent $600,000 keeping things going. And then they came back and they go, I think we're going to wait another quarter.
Oh, no.
And so at that point, we were like, okay, what do we do? It took us like another month to figure out what we're going to do. And then we had to close the doors on the business. And at that point, we had just finished a pro bono job for a nonprofit in Manhattan. And we were doing research on the software applications to do the things that they wanted to do. And this is back in the day when like content management systems were like $300,000 software licenses. And we were like, this is insane. Like, how could nonprofits possibly afford these platforms? This one could, but most of them couldn't. And when we did that, we were like very good at taking processes, making them a lot easier to deliver something, right? But it would be a for-profit endeavor. And in this case, it was to deliver services to people in need. And it was at that moment, sort of like combined with the tragedy of the loss of our business and, you know, this sort of like, what am I doing here? Like, what is my purpose? Why? You know, kind of stuff.
So you start off by building a product directly for a volunteer or a nonprofit.
Our very first product was a website content management system. Basically, this is pre-WordPress, pre-anything like that. So we had a product called Website Plus, and we marketed it just to nonprofit organizations. And it just helped them to have manageable websites where they can have calendaring and articles.
It was first built, you had one client to do it as a custom piece and then went to go to market with it?
No, we did something entirely different for that customer. And we actually implemented a CMS product called BEA at the time. I don't know if they still exist or not. And then we were like, we need to build a product that does this. This is not like the abilities of this product far exceeded what most nonprofits would need. So why don't we build a lighter product version of that and market it to nonprofits, since we couldn't find anything in the space. We were looking for them as part of our engagement, was to say what products are out there.
So the first job was what introduced you to working for nonprofits or serving nonprofits. And then you built the product on the back of that experience. Got it.
Mark, I say quite frequently at SaaS Academy, we work with founders that are very early on still trying to figure out what's the right product, what's the right customer. I think the safe bet I keep coming back to is just fall in love with the problem. What about that first interaction with a nonprofit? Like, you've dedicated over 20 years now to the nonprofit space. What about it kind of got you hooked to say, I'm sure the product shifted and changed over the years, the problems that you're solving, but there's something about that customer. What was it that kind of drew you in and say, hey, this is the part of the world that I want to focus my time and energy on?
I think what it did, it connected my professional life with my personal life. And I very much used to see them as two separate things. And so when we were in business, it was in business. So when I was very, very young, my mother was big on giving back and volunteering and charitable works and big into our church. And so we were volunteering at the bingo games in the 70s, inhaling much too much smoke for somebody my age. And on top of that, when we had sort of this experience with the YMCA when we were young. So my brother and I, we were originally from New York. And so I had a thick Long Island accent. I moved to Connecticut. That accent didn't go over well with the kids from Connecticut. So I had a little trouble meeting friends. And so my parents were like, well, let's get them involved at the Y. We'll drop them off. And to this day, the YMCA is like our best customers. They're fantastic. It's like, I couldn't ask for a better customer avatar. Like, they're the best. And so they dropped us off at this little Fairfield YMCA in Fairfield, Connecticut. And we fell in love with this karate program that they had. And it was entirely run by volunteers, the whole thing, soup to nuts. And we were like obsessed with that place. My brother first started, and then he was like, you gotta come to, he drags me into a lot of stuff.
like companies.
Sometimes kicking and screaming. And then I'm like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Actually, it was pretty damn good. So we ended up getting involved in this program, and it's been a lifelong passion now. My brother has a dojo in Connecticut, and he's trained countless children up into adulthood. He has some kids that started when they were five.
Oh, wow.
Now they're in their 20s. They're getting married and he's being invited to weddings. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. And even those volunteers, I just had 2 days ago, 3 days ago, I just had dinner with one of the volunteers. And he's since become one of my closest friends and mentors. He was an original investor in our product in 2004 when nobody should have been investing in our product. And so he believed in us because of this connection that we had. So he used to volunteer to teach this program. When I first met him, I was 11 years old. He's now 70. I'm now 51. And we still are like super, super close. Our original head teacher is now in his 80s. And we still see him regularly. We have 2 summers ago, we had like a summer camp reunion where all of us 50-year-olds went to summer camp together and did like martial arts for a week. And then even later in my life, myself volunteering or the impact that volunteers had on me, it was just really very much like, what have we been doing with this other thing before? Like it was fun. Like I'll tell you, I love finding a problem and finding a way to fix it. It's like, I'm obsessed with it. The other day we're standing in coffee, waiting for coffee at the intensive. And I'm going, this table is set up all wrong. They have people going from this side to that side, but the garbage is on this side of the, if they just move the can to the other side. And I'm like, am I the only one doing this right now? And I can tell you there's probably like everybody in that room is doing the same
thing. Oh yeah, yeah.
So I love that part of it. And it's that you almost get a high on it when you're like, okay, here's a real serious problem that nobody can seem to solve. And we put something in place that solved it. Like I love that aspect of it. But you transition that and say, well, the problem you're solving is actually to make the world a better place, to make greater impact, to improve people's lives. And then on top of that, the people that I get to talk to every day who may not ever even become customers, I just get on the phone with these awesome organizations. And I'm like, what are you guys doing to change the world? And how are you utilizing volunteers to do that? And every call I get on, I get something out of it. If they never become a customer, I just either made me happy or I learned something new. It's kind of a great way to be. And they share. They're a great community of sharing. Whereas when we did work in the for-profit sector, especially larger companies, it's very much like they don't want to share. It's their IP. They don't even want to share you. They don't even want to tell other people about the dev shop that I have because they want to make sure that they get their time with you. So it's been nice.
Like talking to so many nonprofits, what are you seeing lately, past 5-10 years, on just like the trends of volunteerism in our society? You know, like it's something that's super important to me personally. I can probably draw a through line, and almost everything good in my life, professionally, personally, has come from volunteering in the fire department, volunteering in certain activities, you know, coming up. And so, you know, it's something that I'm passionate about is like, how do you preserve that from a societal standpoint? You know, are you seeing that with the nonprofits you work for? Is it tougher to get people to volunteer their time? Is it a values thing? Like, what are you seeing out there in the world?
I think if there was one good outcome of COVID, I do think that there was a little bit of an awakening on people's responsibilities to their communities. But volunteering has been on the decline. Most of the hours in volunteering happens with baby boomers or older. But the bright spot is that transactionally, they're actually more, it's a higher percentage of younger people volunteering than ever before. They just volunteer less time. So like in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you had people that would like find an organization they felt passionately about and like put a boatload of time behind it. And you see this in other things too. Participation in churches are down. Other, you know, community groups like Kiwanis clubs or, you know, that sort of thing, they're all, those memberships are all down in the US, and they're all surviving by increasing memberships outside the US. But I think the big bright spot is that it started with millennials and it's definitely moving into Gen Z, which is this overall sense that we have a responsibility to give back that I don't think was there. But attention spans have changed too. So, you know, it used to be in previous generations, including mine, muddling through a lot of stuff, there was value in that. So like, if you wanted to help an organization, you could do it clumsily. You could make 10% of the difference with 150% of the time. And people are like, well, that's the way it is. And we value that. Younger generations don't value that. They're like, I should be able to make a big difference like this. I mean, actually me liking something can make a big difference if enough people like something. And all I did was press something with my thumb. So the volunteer organizations, they're a little behind. They're still operating in a lot of cases. Some of them are like crushing it. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of them have that sort of the older mentality, and it's not matching up with younger volunteering. So you need to make things almost effortless for people to actually make an immediate impact. They're holding people to a higher standard. Like, you can't mess with my time. If I'm going to give you my time, if I'm going to give you an hour, it's not going to be wasted. So whereas in the past, they were like, well, just come down. You'll be here for 6 hours. We might get one good hour out of you. And they're like, no, you get one good hour. That's what you get. And so you better be able to do something good with it.
Yeah. I mean, that tracks with what, you know, I still am in touch with a lot of people in the volunteer fire service. And it's the same thing. Like, they'll, you know, if you think about like a sales funnel, like even the process to apply to the fire department and get the background check done and get the physical test done just to get the green light to start volunteering, they'll lose a high degree of applicants just going through that process simply because it takes multiple touch points and 4, 6, 8 weeks, whatever it is, even in that time, because you can't show up and start. It's tough to keep people focused. I can only imagine that's, like you said, it's in every industry.
Yeah. Where we at really kick butt in the marketplace, and this is why I think these RFPs have been good to us, is the onboarding of volunteers. So in the past, all of that really was happening outside of any of the products that were really in the space. Like, you could fill out an application online, maybe sign a waiver, maybe run a background check. In our product, we actually, you can have multiple, and in a lot of cases, the products have like one path. All volunteers go through the same path. And so if there are any differences between different jobs or roles, somebody has to sort of handle that in the back end, which always makes it be like, I was excited to volunteer. Now it's been 2 weeks and I haven't heard from anybody. I fill out a packet this thick, but our product, we have really streamlined that whole process. So like, we take all that stuff under one umbrella and we'll step them through, including like online trainings. We'll track when they need to repeat them, how often they need to repeat them. So for something like a volunteer fireman, there's all sorts of accreditations you need and trainings you need, and they expire after a certain amount of time. It's complex. So we've taken that process and made it really, really easy. I mean, that's all thanks to the YMCAs, because they were on the forefront of taking care of and protecting kids. So they've had these policies in place for a long time about, listen, if you're going to volunteer in a facility that has little kids all running around, swimming pools, locker rooms, bathrooms that are being shared by people, then we better have really good policies in place.
Mark, I think in every business there's, or in SaaS, first find the problem you're excited about and figure out the solution. And then when you start to get some traction there, it shifts into company building, right? So early on, you become the expert on how can we enable volunteer organizations to attract more volunteers. When you kind of get that under your belt, now it becomes about the distribution and the scale. Talk to me about your evolution as a founder on the company building side. What point did you realize that you were playing two games? It was the game of figuring out how to solve this problem and also the game of like distributing it and building the company. And yeah, you know, what have you learning recently?
Well, it's been a long time coming because like you said, we've been doing this for 20 years and pretty much we like hovered for a very, very long time, which was nice. I mean, I raised a family and it gave me earned a living and I got to work with great organizations, but I wasn't building something that could be a legacy. I wasn't building something that if I walked out the door, it wouldn't collapse behind me. And so one of the main things that we've been working on the last few years is like, what are our standard operating procedures? How can I build a process, even if it's a process I'm doing, that is streamlined, well-documented enough that I could hand it off to someone else? And some of the mistakes we made in the past was, it sounds silly even to say it out loud, but what I wanted to do is I wanted to create a legion of, my brother's name is Bob, mini Bobs and mini Marks. And if we could just get those all in, we'd be great, you know? And then I would be continuously frustrated with these people that were poor replicas of myself, but I would give them no resources, no operating procedures. I just expected them to be able to figure stuff out by standing next to us. And that was definitely a frustrating experience and an unfair one to the people that we were bringing in. And what I've since learned, and a lot because of Dan's book, Buy Back Your Time, I was like, oh, I've been doing this all wrong. I need to actually take little pieces of me and say, okay, what are all of the things that I do day to day? And which of those things is something that I actually could create a procedure around and hand it off to somebody else? And so that has changed things recently for us because, you know, like I got an EA, which has been the greatest thing ever. And I actually, we let go of our salesperson. I had one other salesperson besides me. And I kept saying, like, she's wonderful and I love her dearly. I wasn't setting her up in a way where she could eventually be on her own, put those in quotes, because I was expecting her to be a mini me. And so now I actually use my EA to do all of the things that she was actually really doing for me. And I also just found things that were, I could automate much better. So
that's interesting. Can we talk about that for a sec? So like in a, like a ton of our clients are in founder-led sales, right? And a lot of them are also either hiring EAs or have hired an EA. And I think that, that's a pattern that to guys like Johnny and I makes a lot of sense, but maybe to some people, they might think that, oh, I can't use this person in this role for that type of thing. I can't use an executive assistant to do, you know, sales work, SDR work, whatever. So maybe we can double click for a sec on just how are you using your EA? Which of the sales activities is this person doing for you? What's the handoff look like? I think that might be interesting for a lot of people who are in your shoes, you know, being the seller and the face of the company.
So one thing I say to her all the time is I don't want you to be a salesperson. So if it ever feels like that, tell me. Because she didn't sign up for that. And most people don't feel comfortable doing sales. It's like a terrifying thing for them. So what I'll do is we have a great process now. So we record all of my demos. So we're a demo to close model. And so I have a calendar. People come in, they'll sign up, they're group demos. So I might have three organizations on a demo. And I set out certain blocks of time where those are the only blocks that I do demos so that they're not all over the place from day to day. So let's say I have a call, there's three different organizations on the demo. I record it and I use Fathom. And it's freaking fantastic. So it transcribes and summarizes everything. So I go through the whole presentation. At the end, after I've said goodbye to everybody, I just say in the thing, we have a standard template. And I would say, okay, to the Children's Museum, send them template 1A, emphasize a recommendation for our professional product with the LMS add-on. And I'll go through each three of them. And then that's it. When I'm done with that, she goes to the end of the transcript in Fathom and she sees what the follow-up tasks are. And so she does all of my post-demo follow-ups. And then she does all of the check-ins afterwards until it becomes something that where there's something that needs to be done and then it gets assigned to me. And a lot of the work that we were doing prior to that, like my salesperson was doing, was just following up on things to see if there's been progress, if budgets have been approved. So I created a standard set of templates that right now she sends out. I'm trying to figure out a way to automate it. I don't want it to be like the, like I do already have an automated funnel where once they've, you know, they signed up for a demo, they're getting my regular stuff. But this is more like, here's the pricing I promised you. Here's access to a, you know, a sandbox environment you can take a look at. Here's some testimonials. So like the standard, you had a demo with me, and I'm now following up with you. And if you come back to me and tell me our budget cycle is in 3 months, I'm going to put this in my I don't want you to keep getting the, you know, the same routine stuff. So she's at the point where she's sending those out now and then stopping it when it gets less than, you know, or a little bit different off of that path. And then I will follow up with those. But when I tell you that the number of things that I have to follow up on are a fraction of what they used to be. And then of course, if they're anything enterprise, like if they're more than 10K, I take like just an extra, you know, look at those things.
Yeah, it's funny. It makes a lot of sense. And I think that, you know, sometimes we have to delineate between, do I need to be the one clicking the keys or can someone else click the keys, but it's still an accurate representation of the message that I want to convey. And I think that's a really good example to your earlier point of taking a small part of yourself, right? And proceduralizing, operationalizing that small part, empowering someone else to do the follow-up. I think that's a great way to do it. So
it's awesome. Really easy to say, well, this just take me a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the most damaging words in entrepreneurship, right? It'd be faster if I do it myself real quick. No big deal. Yeah.
And it really, because after I read Dan's book, I'm like, all right, now I'm going to do an audit of what I'm spending my time on. And I was like, holy crap. Like that's 2-3 hours a day just following up with people. So I'm like, if I could just eliminate that one thing. And then on top of that, just managing the inbox and my calendar, and people ask for a follow-up. Like every time reconnect with somebody, I give them a link to my calendar. Say, here, if you want to follow up. But people will email back and say, yeah, I'd love to get together. What day works for you? And like, they don't want to use the link. And so she just gets those things. If it's an active opportunity, she'll schedule the call and it just disappears out of my inbox. So like, I'm still like hyper looking at my inbox constantly. I have to stop myself from like intercepting her before she gets to stuff. but I'm getting better and better at that. So I just see, you know, my inbox goes like this, and then it's like, and then it's gone. And then we have a mark review folder if there are things I need to take a look at. It's awesome.
It's funny, man, when people don't do the math, you know, they say, oh, 2-3 hours a day, man, it's like a day and a half a week. You know, so it's like, well, would you ever run your business on 3 days a week? Say, no, probably not. But we are.
And being in SaaS Academy, there's all these strategic things that are for the long-term health and viability of your business that are getting sacrificed constantly for these short-term things. So if you want to put it into like a really dramatic sense, it was like years ago, we used to sell stuff that was outside. We shouldn't have been selling at all. We shouldn't have been doing it all. We're like, we got to feed our families. But it was really sacrificing the future. I always refer to like future Mark or past Mark. Sometimes yeah. I go, past Mark was pretty smart. Look at how he set me
that's
up.
That's future Mark's problem. Don't worry about
like,
that.
Yeah, that's it. Fuck him. But I was like, no, I need to be kind to future Mark. Right, right. He's going to really appreciate it. Believe me.
I like to give future Johnny problems. That works out great for me.
Oh, that's funny. Is there a part of the business now that you feel is, I think growing a business is find and solve the constraint. It's basically, that's the process over and over again. It sounds like you found when I'm not doing sales, I'm missing out on opportunity. There's a constraint there. So it sounds like you've had some great growth and evolution in the area. Is there another area? Like, what are your sights on right now? Where's the constraint?
The biggest thing that made the difference this year was moving up market. And so we were spending a lot of time and energy selling to people that were never going to buy, or taking a lot of time selling to people who are going to spend very little. And because we're in this space, I really genuinely, this is also a curse, I want to help everyone. Like early on in the business, I would be like, you can't afford it. I'm like, but you're doing such good work. Like, what can you afford? Like, I would do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's in the end, that's only going to lessen my impact. So I have to let go of those things and say, okay, if doing that means I can help 50 organizations, but saying, listen, I can't do that for these. Otherwise, for the viability of the business, I could help millions of organizations make a difference. So moving up market was probably the biggest thing because it was also in alignment with the product.
Describe tactically what you mean by when you say, there's one thing to feel, I think we should start working with bigger clients. What are the things you changed in the day-to-day business to help you move up market?
Number one, we changed our messaging. So even like most of our, we were using Capterra to generate leads. And so we just changed our language as to the our profile customer. You know, we were like, listen, if you have hundreds or thousands of volunteers and you know, you have complex things that you need to solve at scale, we're the company for you. And so part of that was, you know, even on our thing to schedule a demo, we put in there, like, what do you think your budget is? And if they said it was less than a certain amount, we said, I don't think we're right for you. And so we just cut out a ton of noise was one.
Two, so messaging into just higher pricing and qualification before the sales call. Awesome.
That's such a good funnel filter too, right? Just like asking, and especially in like that RFP or RFP adjacent type buying behavior, you can just ask that question, what's your budget? Because a lot of industries you ask it like, I don't know. You know, yeah. Like it's a great one.
I had a call with Capterra the other day because they want us to, we reduced our budget with them and moved some stuff over some other places and they want us to spend more. And they're like, you know, if you remove that question, you get a lot more leads. I'm like, yeah, I know.
Follow the incentives, my friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Number one was messaging, qualification of the process. What else is moving up market look like to you?
I mean, definitely going more toward on the RFP front. I think really all that's happened is we've been able to spend more time on the larger opportunities because we've gotten rid of, it's very hard when you're getting inundated constantly. If you're getting 1,000 emails a day and all of them feel equally important and you find that you've just done 60 demos over 2 weeks and you're trying to keep on top of all of them, things fall between the cracks or you don't do as good a job. Your messaging isn't as good. You're not on your game as well enough. And if I get rid of 90 of those and it's just 10 that I'm focusing on and those are the larger opportunities, then of course I'm going to end up landing more of those.
Mark, when we started off the podcast, I mentioned to you that you've been not only a fun client to work with, you've been super influential on our team. And I don't think you knew that until we had, you know, chat before we started shooting the podcast. There was an email that you sent someone on our team that ended up becoming it was a big catalyst for us helping, you know. I think Matt and I got to experience SaaS Academy firsthand and the transformation it had for us. And we've shared to our team the excitement of the transformation that it had in us. But something about the email, and I'd love for you just to kind of share what was going on in your world when you sent that, something about that email helped us really put into words, like, this is what it looks like for SaaS Academy to exist. What was going on in your world when you sent that email?
Well, I've developed this philosophy over time. I feel like that awesome people, awesome organizations, people don't often tell them that they're awesome because they think it's self-evident. Like you have somebody, you got a buddy or even a child who is like super smart and athletic and they've got all of these amazing qualities. You know, they're curious and they're, you know, beautiful and they're kind and you go, well, of course they know this about themselves. So like you tend not, it's like the beautiful woman who never gets asked out, right? So I like personally, I just go, when I see something that I think is really beautiful, kind, whatever it is, I'm going to tell that person. And it really has changed relationships with me. And it helps me to focus on those things. Like I now, because I started that practice, I see more things about people that are freaking awesome. And so that makes every day much more enjoyable for me. So whenever I have the opportunity and whenever I'm feeling something, I go, I should probably tell them that. So I had done a 10-minute tactic in Boston and
Which was amazing. I referenced it multiple times.
That's funny because one of the guys that I've seen like at every conference, he's like, what's up with you? And everybody keep talking about your 10-minute tactic. And you're like a celebrity. I'm like, I don't know.
It was so good. It was so good. We'll have to unpack that in a future conversation. I mean, to interrupt you, but so you did the 10-minute tactic in Boston.
Yeah. And you guys were like, so like, first of all, I saw it as a great compliment and blessing to be able to get up and share something with the group and that people found value in it was really like almost overwhelming for me. And whenever somebody gives you an opportunity to do something like that, that's a gift from, so I felt like that was a gift that you guys gave me. And then I did it and you guys gave me a bunch of gifts. Like I got stuff in the mail and people were like so kind and so generous. And so just in that moment, I was like, I need to let them know what they've done for us and why I would do that. If you asked me to, if there was anything that I could do for SaaS Academy, I would do it because it has changed. I don't even remember who I was as a business person prior to starting. Like we have to remind ourselves all the time. Yeah, we didn't talk like this. We didn't think like this. We didn't have these terms. We weren't tracking these metrics. We didn't think about marketing this way. We didn't think about pricing this way until we got involved. That hopefully happens to everybody in their life, right? Like you look back and go, sometimes my wife and I have been together since I was 14 years old. So we were high school sweethearts and we've been married 27 years. And sometimes we'll get into arguments and she'll bring something up. And I'm like, that was like 10 years ago. I don't even know who that guy was. I'm like, you can't bring that up. Like we're supposed to be evolving and growing. So sometimes it's hard to even, like I said, remember who you were. But before we came to SaaS Academy, we didn't have product tiers. We had one product and it was our enterprise product. And if you were a small nonprofit, we gave you one license, right? So that's like, when we first started out, we got on calls with Marcos and we were talking about pricing and packaging. And we were like, oh, geez, well, this makes so much sense. Well, let's start with that. And I mean, everything from there, everything from messaging to even just how to build a funnel, how to do a demo rocket builder. And we were, when we first started out, there was so much that we needed to do. There was so much content, so much information on how we could be doing things better. We always talk about this in SaaS Academy. It's like, where do I begin? Like the hardest thing was, which things do I focus on first? And I also, one of the things that I realized over time is that Dan said it yesterday. He said, it's not easy, but it is simple. And that one statement really resonates with me because I always feel like I'm definitely an overachiever. I have very big dreams and goals. I don't like to do anything small. And so whenever I go to attack a problem, I want to fucking get all of it, like all at one time, like, all right, let's go. And then you're like if you do it 1,000 miles an hour for, you know, 24 hours a day, then you'll get there faster. And it really is about playing small ball. It's like you do this, build that, do this, build that, and then it stacks. And so right now I feel like we all of a sudden hit this thing where I'm starting to see an exit, you know, a potential exit at some point in the relatively near future. I can see how all of these techniques and tactics, which I can't even tell you which ones they were. Like there's been so many of them. And we actually just did a 2023 year in review because we forget what we did at the start of the year, let alone at the end and why we did it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been transformational.
Well, Mark, it is very hard to create outcomes like that and see progress in the business unless you're showing up and doing the work. So it's been fun getting a chance to meet up multiple times a year, see at the intensives and see the growth and, you know, just the excitement that you and your brother bring to the business. So thank you for being such a, you know, model part of SaaS Academy and for sharing some of your story with us today. Look forward to continuing the conversation, but man, it's been great. Really enjoyed having you on.
Thank you. Appreciate you, brother. Appreciate it.